recording in progress. When did that even start? No, it didn't say start a recording.
Zoom, baby. Zoom.
Good morning, everybody. From the Pacific Northwest, you are watching or listening to another edition of Forward Maryland. I'm Bill Woodcock.
And I'm Steve Hunt. And Bill, as you know, we were talking at the pregame, and I'll repeat it here so you can let the people in on the inside scoop here. Who are you wearing today?
Well, Steve, seeing as I'm in the Pacific Northwest, I am rocking the City Connect hat of the Seattle Mariners. You will note the original Mariners logo from 1977, the updated look, the color scheme, the black bill of the hat. For my money, this is one of the sharper City Connect color schemes that have been devised for the various teams. So, and especially thought it was apropos to wear today, seeing as I am in the Pacific Northwest. This is not Columbia. I'm not in Columbia. I'm in the Pacific Northwest.
Well, Bill, if I could bring it back home for a second, I don't know if you see the, I guess it was leaked. I hope it's not the real City Connect jersey for the Orioles, but it looks not unlike the Great Britain jersey from the World Baseball Classic. It not good.
You know, you walked into this one just like this little bumblebee is walking into some trouble flying around me. I know exactly what you're talking about, and I'm going to roundly pshaw that notion that jersey is not good. First off, I do believe that is the actual City Connect jersey. And for those watching or listening at home, the Orioles City Connect jersey looks to be black with just white block letters, Baltimore across it, with orange and black sleeves. And it looks like a multicolored collar, which matches the multicolored map of Baltimore that appears on the alleged socks of said City Connect jersey. It also looks like the hat is going to have a script B on the front. I find this actually quite cool, and I'll tell you why. First off, we don't know what the rest of the uniform looks like. Sure. Secondly, a lot of the City Connects are hearkening back to historic nuances, historic things about the city. Boston uses the blue and yellow colors of the Boston Marathon. Washington uses the cherry blossoms. They have like a pink and dark gray thing. Seattle with their hat. The Dodgers with Los Dodgers. The Colorado Rockies with the colors of the classic Colorado Rockies hockey team, and also other nods to other former professional sports teams in Colorado. Baltimore, the plain black and white Baltimore jersey, says to me a few things. It says to me Baltimore Believe, which has been a thing for a long time. It says to me, the block lettering says to me the names of Baltimore's most TV shows, of which Baltimoreans themselves are most proud: Homicide, Life on the Streets, and The Wire. There's a certain amount of urban grit, I think, in that design. But most importantly, the black and white Baltimore jersey is reminiscent of perhaps the best baseball team of the 19th century and probably going for the first quarter of the 20th century, the National League Baltimore Orioles of 1894 to 1900, the team that brought us the likes of Wee Willie Keeler, Wilbert Robinson, and John McGraw. So that is where I see that going. I see that as relevant to Baltimore's history. I guess that got a whole lot of yucks, and it looked like the Great Britain jerseys from the World Baseball Classic. But honestly, if you even looked at that jersey within the entire context of its uniform, that really wasn't that bad. There have been some fails in the City Connect series. If you look at Cincinnati's one that was just released yesterday, the Texas one. Those kind of suck. But I'm very optimistic about the Baltimore offering. We'll know a week from Monday when it's unveiled.
Yeah, and let me be clear. I love the Script B hat. That is, I will be buying one of those hats. I don't know if I will be able to get one before we wrap up the podcast, but I will be acquiring one of these Script B hats. Those things are tight. And you're right, Bill. The picture I saw did not feature the sleeves. I did see the collar, but the collar is mostly on the inside from what I remember. So I don't know how much pop you're going to get from that, but you know, perhaps there's something on the sleeves, on the slot, on the sides. But, you know, I would have liked to have seen a reference to Charm City as opposed to just Baltimore, but that's just me. If they're going to go with, you know, historical elements, that's fine. But, again, we'll wait and see. I mean, I've always loved the Orioles black jerseys. It's like one of my favorite ones. The orange one is kind of my first love, but the black one's always been one that I've enjoyed. So we'll see.
Well, if you go back to, I recommend a book called Where They Ain't, which is the story of the National League Orioles. And you will find there quite an impressive story of Baltimore's Big Four, the three I mentioned, you know, Wee Willie Keeler. There's a shortstop, I believe, named Huey Jennings, John McGraw, and Wilbert Robinson. They were some fantastic baseball players. It was the super team of the late 1890s. What happened to them is that there is an attempt to trade that team for the then Brooklyn Superbas, who then became the Brooklyn Dodgers, but that fell through. So there was instead collusion so that all the Orioles players were sold off, notably to the then New York Giants. But then the Orioles franchise was taken away and given to New York and moved to the American League so there would be no chance of collusion. That team was then had no nickname, then was known as the New York Islanders in 1901, and then took on the name Yankees in 1903. So very interesting stuff about the world of baseball before the 20th century.
Yeah.
Steve, we've already, that's been quite a warm-up. That was not the warm-up I was planning, but that was a good one.
Well, I walked into it, so there you go. And you're right.
And we'll get more into baseball in a bit. But we are waiting on a guest who I hope will join us, but we'll see. But we, you know, the show must go on. Steve, the first item is that escalated quickly. Now, what has it been? About 2 weeks since Ben Cardin decided he wasn't running for the Senate. For re-election from the Senate from the great state of Maryland. And now we have four candidates in the race, three of which I would say would be serious, two of which I would say would be most well-heeled, those being Congressman David Trone, Prince George's County Executive Angela Alsobrooks. The two have already come out with videos.
Yep.
Oh, yes, please do so now, guest. So our guest is on his way, perhaps. Spinning it on two wheels, but we'll see. So we have, I don't know if we should vamp or if I should just keep describing or if you should just go, Steve. Anyway, and then also we have Montgomery County Councilman Vince Gerwando. We do not have this bumblebee who is really taking to my yellow shirt. And also the ever popular Democratic activist Gadfly, Jerome Segal. Steve, the race has been joined. While we are waiting for our guests to join, and while I'm sitting here in the Pacific Northwest, this is not Columbia. What are you taking of these very, very early steps, you know, into this race? And is this field already firmed up?
You know, with the early moves that have happened, it may well be. I think that I was very surprised, to your point, of the quick escalation, you know, especially, you know, County Executive Alsa Brooks and Congressman Trone, you would think because, as you said, they are very well-heeled. Translation, they got money. I would have thought folks like that would have waited and kind of seen how things unfolded. Obviously, Juwando, Siegel, they need to get in early to get as much name rec as they can as quickly as humanly possible. But the fact that those two jumped in, you do have to wonder, because does the Trone entry basically eliminate Raskin, you know, member of Congress and also member of Congress, John Sarbanes? Do his fellow colleagues in the House of Representatives decide, okay, you know, Trone, you can go for this thing. We're just going to stay where we're at. You have to wonder, in terms of also Brooks, does that freeze out, county executives? Actually, Stuart Pittman has already endorsed her. There's been no word yet from the county executives of Montgomery, Howard, and Baltimore. Those are your other three notables. But you got to wonder what they might do. Oh, there's the bumblebee on your screen, Bill. The bumblebee has entered the chat. But yeah, you have to wonder if also Brooks' entry eliminates some of those folks. Also, Kwesi Mfume has already jumped on board to endorse the county executive, also Brooks. So yeah, maybe you get some fringe candidates. I mean, we talked last time about, you know, there would be a strong woman candidate, backed by organizations like an Emerge, you know, Emma's List and others. Is also Brooks going to be that candidate, which eliminates, you know, some of the other notable women, you know, state and local? So you're right. I mean, what I thought was going to be a pretty big field, I think the Trone and also Brooks entries that early might knock that field down by a lot. And certainly in terms of big name candidates. Oh, here we go. Connecting to audio. Ladies
and gentlemen. I'll make the announcement. You just keep doing what you're doing.
Well, I was going to say, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, Warren Maryland proudly introduces to you our guest. And we'll just jump right back in.
Didn't I just say I was going to announce him?
Do it.
Wait a minute.
And then let me announce our guest, please.
Wait a minute. Hang on.
From your thought.
No, go for it. I'm done. I'm good.
Jesus Christ.
Is that an original Seattle Mariner hat?
It is. Hello, Len. Yes, it is a Seattle
Mariner
hat.
That is the original Seattle Mariners hat, vintage 1977. The very one that was worn by Diego Seguí when he pitched the very first game in franchise history in the Old Kingdom.
Wow. Oh, the memories of the Pilots were washed away when
Diego Seguí
took that mound in that first game in April of 1977 in the venerable, late lamented Seattle Kingdom.
But Diego Seguí, as baseball enthusiasts will recall, is the only player to have pitched for both the Pilots and the Mariners.
That's true.
And for that, earned this sobriquet, the Ancient Mariner.
Wasn't that later appointed onto Jamie Moyer?
Well, yes. Because he pitched well, because Jamie pitched well into his 40s. And I don't have it in front of me. I think Jamie actually went on to log just under 260 career wins.
Yes. I mean,
he hung around long enough to amass borderline Hall of Fame credentials.
Yeah.
Yes. And who knows? I mean, who knows in this era of semi-watered down Hall of Fame ballots if he might find himself lucking in. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, our guest for today is the inimitable Len Foxwell. Len, welcome to the podcast. You have earned your 3-appearance smoking jacket, sir.
Oh my goodness. I would gladly trade in my 3-appearance smoking jacket for just a 1-hour visit with both of you at Sapwood Cellars, located in Columbia, so at the time of your choice.
Oh, well, absolutely. We're on.
Speaking of which, I have to give a shout out to our guest, Bill, because something that he did on social media that I was just impressed with. So just really quickly, you know, we have these days where people decide to just become something else. You know, St. Patrick's Day, everybody's Irish, you know, a little bit of Guinness, wear some green, I don't know, crank up some House of Pain, I don't know what the hell you do. Cinco de Mayo, you know, you get your Dos Equis, your Corona, or your libation full of tequila. So what do I see on Cinco de Mayo from Mr. Foxwell on his social media feed? No Dos Equis, no Corona, no margarita, a picture of a lovely Maryland craft beer. Now, Len, you can tell us who you were wearing in terms of the craft beer, but I love the fact that you said, I don't conform to this. I'm a craft beer guy for life, and this is how I roll, no matter what the day. Shout outs, man.
Thank you so much, Mr. Hunt. Thank you for, first of all, subscribing to my Facebook page and taking time to watch my content. I'm grateful for that. On that particular day of days, I was enjoying a mushroom-infused red IPA from Waverly Brewing off of Union Avenue in Baltimore. And to the untrained ear, a mushroom ale may sound a little less than appetizing because those are two concepts that don't necessarily go together. But I have found that the mushroom actually provides an earthy, kind of very fresh front note that kind of blunts the nose of the IPA, and it creates a very, very smooth mouthfeel. And it's actually become one of my favorite beers. And I will also say that Alex Yukna, who is the co-owner along with his amazing wife, Melissa, was one of my best, most trusted Hopstart mentors and judges during this past competition cycle, which is a program I'm doing at Bill's alma mater, the Johns Hopkins University.
Indeed, indeed. And I would say that, you know, I too saw the picture of this mushroom ale, and I appreciate your description, Len, because that's exactly how I would have envisioned a mushroom ale to be. And the concept of a mushroom ale does not really strike me as any more odd than an oyster porter, which I have experienced in my lifetime, which also brings a similar flavor. As the name would suggest, the oysters are in the brewing barrels. So that certainly, and that goes back to a time when, you know, meat products like chickens, you know, I believe there is an old British brewing tradition of cock ale, which actually includes a mangled chicken as part of the wort, as they call it. I would say that is most unappetizing here, now, and forever. But oyster porter was quite yummy, and I could imagine that mushroom ale, as long as it's the right kind of mushrooms, would be good as well.
It really is, and to the point of the oyster porter, I would think that the purposes are somewhat analogous, because the oyster gives kind of like a kind of a briny, fresh taste to the porter, and kind of offsets that kind of dark, strong front note that you sometimes get from deeper, more cocoa and coffee based porters. So I definitely try it again. That they call it the Baltimore the Beer Muta Triangle. It's Union Craft Brewing over on 41st Street at the Union Collective, Waverly Brewing on Union Avenue, and then literally right across the street is Pariah Brewing, which is in the old Union Brewing production facility.
Mm-hmm. So in this anti-penultimate episode, this is maybe our greatest Grateful Dead-like riff in the middle of an actual topic that we have ever ensued upon, which, you know, I'm okay with that. So getting back to the business of the day, Len, we were in the middle of a discussion when you joined us, and we were talking the Maryland Senate race, and we were just talking about how the entry of two of the perceived major candidates, Trone and also Brooks, about what effect these might be having on attempting to force out and force on, you know, force to the sidelines a Jamie Raskin, a John Sarbanes, John Olszewski. And Steve was explaining to us how he definitely sees how that could may very well be the case when you join. What say you?
So I think to understand the dynamics of the Senate race as the candidates inch toward the starting line, I believe you have to break down the numbers that tell the story. And what you have to understand more than anything else is that the votes disproportionately are in the Washington suburbs. And the balance of power in terms of strength within a Democratic primary has shifted, I mean, almost 180 degrees from metropolitan Baltimore to metropolitan DC over the past 30 some odd years. So what do I mean by that? So if you look at the 2022 Democratic gubernatorial primary, which is really the most recent and reliable data set that we have, 21% of that primary electorate that participated in that race that was eventually won by Westmore over Tom Perez, Peter Frangio, and others, 21% came from Montgomery County, 19% came from Prince George's County. So that's 40% of the statewide electorate just in those jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. Now, you add to that Frederick County, which is a geographic and philosophical extension of Montgomery County, and Charles, which has become really a fully vested suburb of Prince George's County, culturally, economically, demographically, that number gets you to 46%. And so almost five of every 10 voters in a Democratic primary are going to come from what we now call the Potomac Rim.
Right.
And so compared to that, the largest single exporter of Democratic primary voters in the Baltimore metropolitan region is Baltimore County. It's only 12%. Baltimore City is just about 10%. You throw in places like Carroll, Harford, the subsection of Howard and Anne Arundel that exists east of Route 32 and therefore gravitates more toward Baltimore in terms of where it gets its information and the commute patterns. And you get to about 32% of the electorate. So it's 46% in Metro DC, 32% in Baltimore, and then the rest are the rural areas and the non-aligned areas. And you can see why the three announced candidates are all from metropolitan Washington.
Mm-hmm.
That said, you know, if you have one strong Baltimore candidate who would have the ability to raise $10 million for a Senate race, who would have a built-in inventory of name recognition, has the experience that comes with having had their name on prior ballots, they could take advantage of a crowded Democratic field that's weighted toward Metro DC and eke out a low win number plurality of 30 to 35%, which is not unlike what Wes Moore did by beating Tom Perez. I think it was 32 to 30% in the 2022 race, 15,000 vote margin, and Wes was the only one that was coming explicitly out of Metro Baltimore, while Perez, Francho, Gansler, John King, Barron, others were coming out of D.C. He took advantage of the regional split.
So a local Democratic official, member of the Central Committee, and if I mention this person's name, which I'm not going to mention, you would know who it is, Len, but also somebody who's been a Peter Francho enthusiast in his time, made mention to me recently, informally, that would be the Trone path, would be to maybe claim the stake as that Baltimore candidate. And, you know, that seemed like a little bit of a prescient suggestion, as I saw David Trone's first campaign commercial, which was filled with scenes in the fair city of Baltimore. You know, I think the only thing was the Trone Farm, wherever that might be, was not within Baltimore city limits. So do you think that that's his plan, you know, to pick up as enough of a split? And do you see, I mean, you know, so that's one question. And the second question I have is, what other candidate fits the bill? Do an Olszewski or Sarbanes? I can't imagine it would be both. You know, is there still a field fertile enough for one of them to run and win?
So I'll take this in order. I think what Trone is trying to do at this early stage is, I call it the Drago strategy. After Ivan Drago in Rocky IV, where he just went in for the first round knockout. He went in for the kill and tried to make this race a lopsided TKO before it even starts. And that's why you see a full-throated effort. You know, he's putting his ads on the air. He's putting his stamp all over digital media. I drove from Baltimore to Salisbury on Friday for a series of meetings and was listening to the C4 show on WBAL and heard his radio ad no fewer than six times during that time block. So clearly he's going to have the money to compete. I mean, a lot of candidates will brag and say somewhat hyperbolically, I will spend whatever it takes, only to find out that they don't have the resources or don't have the political will to push every single chip they have into the center of the table. David Trone absolutely will.
And David Trone in these ads sounds more like, you know, Johnny, the sales manager at Anderson Ford, than he does the magnate of Total Wine and Trone Advertising, whose personal net wealth is at least nine figures.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he has learned over the course of his time as the congressman from a district that includes several working class communities, and I'm thinking about places like Hagerstown, Hancock, Cumberland, Oakland, not just the northern and western Montgomery County precincts that form the nexus of his political base. I think he has not only leaned into his persona as a working class candidate, despite his enormous personal wealth, but he's learned how to communicate ideas and priorities in a way that actually resonate with people on the ground. I think his time is so many people these days think that they can come in and start at the top. Mm-hmm. It is both a problem and a symptom of our political system where someone with no prior political experience decides that they want to be a U.S. senator, they want to be a governor. And most of the time, these candidates are unsuccessful. Wes Moore did succeed because he has very special political qualities. Most of these candidates don't succeed because it does take a compelling message in addition to the mechanics of a successful campaign, and those are learned skills. David Trone is a much better Senate candidate today because he has been the congressman from the 6th Congressional District. He has improved so much from what I saw from him during his early days on the campaign trail running against Jamie Raskin back in 2016.
Steve, your response to Len's comments.
No, I think those comments are spot on. You know, the one thing that struck me about the Trone ad, because I saw the one with the podium in it, and I think there was another one as well, they didn't feel like the ads of somebody who's worth as much as David Trone. They didn't feel slick. They didn't feel glossy. They almost felt like an outsider who scraped up enough money to run a halfway decent ad. It just didn't feel like it was from some rich guy who could throw like $10 million in an ad. It just had that sense. The other thing to your Baltimore point that you guys were making was, you know, he talked about how as part of his franchise Total Wine, you know, he was the first one to eliminate what he called the box as far as whether or not you've been previously incarcerated. That sounds to me like something that could play in Baltimore. So, no, some really good points there. And I think that Trone, it almost feels like he's trying to run as an outsider. He's talking about no PAC money, things of that nature, versus an also Brooks who's going to pretty much have all of the, you know, name a name, they'll probably end up backing her at some point. My question to you, Lynn, and you may have already answered it, but I'd like for you to just expand on it a little bit. I was wondering, you know, Bill and I talked about this before, about what I call the gubernatorial class of 22. Obviously, the governor's mansion is locked down, I would say, all the way through the 26th election. Even if Westmore does something, it won't be until 28. And obviously, Aruna Miller's already there. So I was thinking about, obviously not, former comptroller Francho, but some of the others who ran, would they jump in seeing this as a very rare opportunity and might be their last opportunity to get in the mix? But then you talked about where they were located. That might not be so easy for them when you already have an also Brooks standing out there in Prince George's and a Trone sitting out there in Montgomery. So do those two being in the race already pretty much freeze out that gubernatorial class of 22?
So I want to answer that question, and I want to go back to a point that you were making, Steve, earlier. So to the first point, or the first question about could we see some of the 2022 class redirect into a Senate race, I suppose anything is possible, right? Especially given the fact that the majority of these candidates in 2022 had nothing to lose. They weren't current office holders. And so they were liberated to go and run for high office without giving anything up. I don't think that a candidate like a Tom Perez, for instance, would risk incurring a second consecutive election defeat. I think he ran a very, very good race in 2022 against a world-class politician and came within 15,000 votes of winning the nomination. I think that he came out of that race with a reservoir of political capital and goodwill. I don't think he would risk it on a race in which David Trone is going to spend upwards of $40 million and more, if that's what it takes, or run against an Angela Alsobrooks, who will have both the institutional support within the Democratic Party and a historic dimension to her race as the would-be first Black woman to ever serve as a U.S. senator from the state. I do think what you'll see, Steve, are maybe some people who are, for whom this would be a mid-cycle race, because council members, county executives, legislators, delegate senators, run 4-year terms, and this election is happening in the middle of that term. They would not have to resign and vacate their current seats in order to run for the U.S. Senate. So I think that you will see some take a look at it, ultimately decide against it. But I do think there'll be some lawmakers and council members out in the 6th congressional district who might be compelled to run that race because it is an equivalent of a free throw. If I may, I want to go back to the David Trone ad and address some of the points you were making, Steve, because I think in those ads, which are really good, mm-hmm. I think you see three things happening. One, to your point, he is clearly positioning himself as the outsider. And I think that is not only something that is stylistically preferable, for him it's absolutely necessary because Angela is going to run with the institutional support within the party, starting with the tacit, if not the direct support from the governor, who owes so much of his political success to her endorsement in 2022. So I think he has to kind of reset the frame from being the moderate white guy in the race running against the woman who would be the first Black woman to serve in the U.S. Senate from Maryland. I think he has to flip that narrative. That's not a good one for him. He has to flip it to outside versus inside. It's not analogous to what we did with Peter Francho back in the day, when he ran it regularly to the right of the rest of the Democratic field, we didn't allow him to be defined by points on the political spectrum. Because a liberal, someone who's left of center, will always have an advantage in a Democratic primary process against someone who is more moderate or more moderate conservative. What we did was we flipped the dichotomy and we made it outsider versus insider. And then what you get there is a broader coalition of Democrats who feel, for whatever reason, they have been left behind by the insiders. And you get disaffected Reagan Democrats, you get suburban good government types, and you even get, Black and ethnic voters who feel like they've not been let into the club by the Annapolis and Washington establishment. The other thing that he is doing is he is trying to tamp down what will be the inevitable claim that he is an economic plutocrat trying to buy the election by leaning into his working class roots. And he did grow up in a working class environment, rural, on a rural farm. And the third thing is he's already taking steps to put the fact that he is the owner of Total Wine and Spirits and define that experience in positive terms, because that is, in the alcohol industry, that is the Walmart that is regarded as the big titan trying to, push all the mom and pops out. What he's doing is he's resetting the narrative before somebody can come in and do it for him. Mm-hmm. Mm. So lots going on in that ad. Yeah. All of it is tactically smart, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do as well. Like I said, I thought the fact that he intentionally made it not so glossy was mm-hmm. a good thing.
Agreed.
Because, also, Brooke, I mean, just her rollout video was, it had all the music and the vibe. I mean, it was your classic, beautiful, feel-good, inspirational thing. And then here's Trone running around the podium strapped to the back of a truck. I thought it was great. I thought it was very, very well played.
My concern about Angela, and I'll just be candid with you guys, my concern is that because she is perceived at this early stage of the race to be the front runner based on the size of her natural political base in Prince George's County and the fact that she is going to run with the support of the traditional power brokers in the party, when you become the front runner this early, you have so many, and both of you have seen this, we can count the countless examples, you have so many consultants and advisors and senior staff and would-be political gurus around the state and donors and former Congressman X and former Senator Y all whispering in your ear, here's what you ought to say, here's what you shouldn't do. Can't use this word, let's use that word. Your message becomes shaved and sanded and stripped down so many ways that you end up saying nothing. And she has to really, really avoid being the candidate who is running on her narrative without anything to say. Because if Angela will just be Angela, she is a brilliant, talented, smart woman who is of the moment with a resume that's second to none. But consultants have a way of basically stripping a message down to the point where it tries to appease everyone, and mm-hmm. therefore it speaks to nobody.
Right. Absolutely. I want to move on because we've got a couple other topics and we could talk about, we could spend a whole episode on this. And as I keep saying, we only have two left. So Len, I'm going to kick off this second one and put it over to you. But I don't know, Len, if you heard the podcast last week when I spoke of the advent of what I consider news entertainment, named after, of course, sports entertainment, which all three of us know well to refer to the world of professional wrestling. News entertainment is kind of analogous. That is a news-ish program in the same way in which George Santos considers himself Jew-ish. where supposed news is disseminated at an event, but in reality, it becomes a spectacle and it becomes a traveling roadshow. And all it does is it suck up media vacuum for the next news cycle or two after. Witness the case of CNN's town hall, quote unquote, with Donald Trump on Wednesday. Not sure how anybody else thought that it was going to go any different than what it did, with Trump bloviating in front of a friendly audience. You know, and I say bloviating, but I think all three of us here realize that this man has insanely acute political skills. He knows exactly what he's doing. He's not a stupid man. And he did everything that he did for reason and purpose. You know, but was it news or was it entertainment? I think it was both. I think CNN knew it. Then I believe this was a very early on example, or perhaps not so early on, of this new genre that I am more than happy to take credit for naming. And damn it, I'll even trademark it if I got it. What do you think?
I think what happened on, what was it, Wednesday night?
Wednesday.
Yeah.
I think it is a symptom of a media universe that has gone horribly wrong. We are adrift because we now live in a world where the economics of the industry no longer favor and can no longer sustain objective, honest, journalistic coverage of the events of the day and reward both products that entertain and reinforce the biases of the viewer. So what do I mean by that? I teach this, I teach communications at the collegiate level, as I think you both know. And one of the things I always do as a thought exercise at the beginning of each semester is I ask my students, where do they get their information from? You know, first thing, we all have that one outlet, right? When you wake up in the morning, you lean over, you get your laptop, your iPad, you know, you go to that one site first before all others. And to a person, it is either one of the ideologically tilted, what I call the reinforcement products, MSNBC or CNN on one end of the spectrum, or Fox News on the other end of the spectrum, or more often than not, it is one of the aggregated content sites such as Apple News or Google News. And what we know about that is that no two Apple News feeds are alike, right? Because your algorithm, which is the product of your browsing history, your consumer purchase history, your social media content, it's going to result in a different product being presented to you than I get. And so the common denominator between that, those products, the aggregated news sites, the reinforcement media such as MSNBC and Fox News, and the non-traditional media such as blogs and podcasts and such, is that it's designed not to give the consumer the information they need, but to give us what we want to hear. And so gone are the days when we could count on the likes of Walter Cronkite and Peter Jennings and Tom Brokaw being the most trusted men in America at any given point in our epoch. And instead, we have CNN that is literally trying to behave like a political candidate, trying to position itself ideologically. The new corporate leadership feels, and this has been well documented in the press, as if the Jeff Zucker era positioned CNN too far to the left. Mm-hmm. So maybe we have to go back to the center right to broaden our appeal to more viewers. And having Donald Trump on air to spew his lies and to a cheering audience of MAGA bots is a way to do it. when you have news organizations acting like political organizations, trying to find its sweet spot on the ideological spectrum, then you know we are hopelessly adrift, because I want my news product to be objective, fact-based, without fear or favor. And that just doesn't exist anymore, given what we're seeing with the decline of the traditional media and newspapers going out of business and traditional TV and radio and news being stripped down to the axles.
I'm so glad that you picked up what I was putting down there, Len, because this is exactly how I want to address this. Not in terms of what Trump said. We know this. We've seen this nonsense for 8 years now on the national level. But what does it say about our media environment when we are trumpeting things, no pun intended, as news, where clearly there should be no expectation of any actual news content being formed by that experience? And sure as shooting, to everything that you said, sure as shooting, CNN grabbed this event, so to speak, and they ran with it the whole next day. Mm-hmm. Now, what I do notice is that it didn't really gain any legs. So in terms of what I feel was CNN's own calculation was to give Trump an open microphone for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and see what nonsense comes out that then everybody could pick up and run for the next 2 or 3 days or in through the weekend. I think they overplayed their hand, and you know, there wasn't enough antagonism. Like you said, a crowd of cheerleaders. There wasn't anybody standing up to say, you know, you nincompoop, you're the reason why January 6th happened, other than the moderator, who's a pleasant and capable and smart young woman. But you know, I think she was put in there so that she could get run over and appear victimized, which she did. And it was just a cluster. It was poorly played theater in the world of news entertainment.
And let me add to that before, Len, you jump back in here. I was watching something last week, and it was interesting. This reporter, it was kind of a roundtable with this. One guy was saying, look, since 2016, there are three people who have sat down and looked Trump eye to eye and have made him uncomfortable. Jonathan Swan in 2020, Jake Tapper in 2016, and Chris Wallace in 2020. Two of those individuals are employed by CNN, and neither one of them got this assignment. And I think, Bill, to your point, that's why. Because you imagine him trying that on a Jake Tapper or a Chris Wallace? Oh, hells no.
Well, Caitlin Collins was the White House correspondent during the Trump administration, and so it was a natural fit. But my point was more.
That's a different environment, though.
She wasn't empowered to back up. She wasn't empowered like, say, Savannah Guthrie was in 2020 when she said, you know, you're not Uncle Charlie at the Thanksgiving table. You just can't make this stuff up. She didn't do that. My hypothesis is because of the greater willingness in the corporate level to create an event.
Right.
Was to give him a stage and to go off of the hypothesis that the best way to get him going is just to let him rant. So again, Steve, my comment is not so much what he said. I could care less what he said. He said nothing that brought any value to my life. But my concern is how it was played by, you know, what is arguably the most well-known brand in news in the world.
It's been a horrible, horrible year for CNN. If you think about the response that CNN has received to this travesty, and I want to go back and say that I don't, with all due respect to Chris Wallace or Jonathan Swan or Jake Tapper, who are amazing, I don't think anybody could have succeeded in the town hall format. Because I think that if they wanted to have a hard-hitting discussion of facts, with points and counterpoints, they would have done it in a studio and not in a something that is ridiculously named a town hall meeting, because it was anything but a town hall.
Yeah.
It was a political rally. And they get and they the fact that Trump was surrounded by his adoring acolytes gave him an insurmountable home field advantage, right? So I want to so you talk about the Trump thing, and then you talk about the Don Lemon thing that happened just a few weeks ago. And it's just another example of how when we when Steve and Bill and Len want to find out the truth about something, whether it is what's really happening with the crisis on the southern border of the United States, or what's happening with the war in Ukraine, what's happening with the politics of abortion bans, you, you name the issue, where do you go to find the absolute truth? Fewer and fewer people from both sides of the political spectrum would say, I can get the truth from CNN. You know, and we know you can't get the truth from Fox News. They sit on a throne of lies. But so the question is, where do you go? And when, you know, when we as a society lose the ability to achieve consensus on what the facts are, when we all have our own definition of truth based on where we sit on the political spectrum, then there's no chance for us to come together, because we can't even agree on the material facts of the issue before we can achieve a consensus on the solutions to the problem. And that's a really corrosive thing for our, not only our political discourse, but for society as a whole.
Yeah, let me ask you this question, Len, especially with your background in communications and, you know, actually teaching it. You know, Bill asked a great question about what does it mean to media in general. I want to ask you, what does it mean to 2024? Because when I thought about this Trump town hall, we'll put air quotes on that animal, I thought about, my first thought was, great, more free media for Donald J. Trump. And that's really what he rode all the way home in 2016. You know, any microphone he wanted to find, he found it, and people put him on TV no matter what the network is. And Joe Biden, while he is a very skilled politician, we've seen him at some really good moments this year, he is still more of an old school traditional politician. Yes, he's got people around him. He's, his media team is very good. His social media team is very good. But he's outgunned against Donald Trump, who is a very unique animal in the way in which he has been able to mold politics and entertainment. As Bill was saying about the news entertainment media, what does it mean to 2024 that clearly we are not done with Donald Trump? We're going to have to deal with Donald Trump.
I think Donald Trump goes into the 2024 cycle as the prohibitive favorite for the nomination, as we've seen. The Ron DeSantis balloon is losing altitude by the day. He's turning out to be so much more ham-handed than any of us would have imagined. And none of the other challengers seem to be taking flight. Here's something else that's interesting about CNN. What the question that is not being asked in this whole CNN debacle with Trump is, what about the equal time doctrine? Wasn't there something back when we were all growing up where you couldn't, you know, if you invited Donald Trump to come onto the stage for a half hour, well, then you would have to extend that same opportunity to the other announced candidates, Asa Hutchinson, Nikki Haley. I don't recall if Tim Scott has actually announced his candidacy yet, but if he has, you'd have to invite him too, right? Well, that's gone out the window. Why? Because CNN is a cable news outlet and they are not governed by the Federal Communications Commission. The airwaves are public property, government property. The cable lines are not. They can say, they can put out whatever they want, whenever they want it, spew all the garbage they want. So what does it mean? What does all this mean for the politics of 2024? It means that whoever the Republican and Democratic nominees are going to be, we're still, as a people, going to be talking to each other within our respective silos. Progressive Democrats like me are only going to get our information from other progressive news outlets, be it blogs, podcasts, websites, TV, whatever. And folks, you know, like a couple of the old boys I saw down at C Street in St. Michael's yesterday, they're going to get it from, you know, old Ward Ewing coming in to get his beer at the bar. They're going to get it from the other side.
Right.
And so our country's going to remain completely divided because we are conditioned to believe that only our side is absolute truth. And we're not even giving ourselves the intellectual tools to hear and therefore be able to either be persuaded or to refute the other side's arguments. Mm-hmm. We don't get persuaded to change our minds anymore because we, as a society of news consumers and information consumers, we don't even hear the other side.
Wow, that's a scary thought, Bill. I'll go back to you.
I mean, it is what it is.
Wow.
And this is, you know, I joke about this whole news entertainment thing, but that's is exactly where we're going.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, everything is about market share and, you know, penetration of the market and less about actual facts, less about actual data, less about actual evidence, you know, and these things happen in matters small and large. I mean, as mundane a thing as the weather person on the morning news in WBAL talking about the wildfires in Canada being the reason why the air looks smoky here this past week. Did anybody know that there were wildfires in Canada? I didn't know. You know, the wildfires are right north of us. I went to CBC to look it up. They're pretty bad wildfires. They're terrible wildfires, in fact. I mean, just as bad, if not worse, than what we experience in our West. But why don't we know about it? Beats the hell out of me. But I will tell you, CNN took about 4 minutes on Friday that they could have spent talking about Canadian wildfires and their effect upon the American weather and the possible effect upon the climate. They took 4 minutes that they could have spent talking about that, and they talked about Natalie Holloway. You know, the young lady from Alabama who went missing 18 years ago. There's absolutely no thread of my life where I think about Natalie Holloway. Yeah.
I was just talking about this the other day. I mean, I once in a while I will go and like at the top of at like 7 o'clock in the morning, which is when the American news cycle really begins in earnest. That's when the big three morning shows go live.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I will go back and forth and just see what everyone is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is the insubstantive soap opera politics of personality of the moment. And, you know, whether it's Donald Trump said this about Joe Biden or Joe Biden said this about Donald Trump. And this morning, for instance, I was watching, I was flip-flopping between CNN and Fox News, and CNN was bashing Trump. Fox News was bashing Biden. Meanwhile, we have a U.S. banking system that is in some degree of crisis, depending on which regulator or official you speak to, which will have an extraordinary effect on the health of the American economy. We have a debt crisis that no one has taken the time to truly understand and explain why we got here and what the practical effects would be on our fiscal well-being, our economic health, the likelihood of a recession, interest rates, our ability to buy a home, save for college, whatever. And so you see the performative aspects of politics and government being emphasized at the expense of those issues that may not be as glamorous, but are more meaningful to our daily lives. And again, Bill, Steve, that gets back to your conversation about the economics of the industry and how it's chasing entertainment eyeballs and clicks and shares and not necessarily focusing on their obligation to inform the public.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about something a lot more fun, guys. We are at the quarter pole of the Major League Baseball season. And if there is one story that is emerging, and certainly I don't know what other stories there can be emerging at this early point in the season, but, and maybe this is Homer bias, although remember, I'm in the Pacific Northwest. It has to be the Baltimore Orioles.
Are you there now, Bill? Are you in the Pacific
Northwest? No, I'm sitting in my house.
Okay. That's a great, that is a great hat, by the way. I just
cannot. Well, that hat's awesome.
Gorgeous. I mean, this is, we've talked about the Orioles City Connect before you came on and what that might be looking like. But this, I mean, I know you have your opinions about the Nationals cherry blossom colorway. And I'm kind of with you on that. I actually do have the Washington hat. That's about the only part of it I can stomach, to be honest. But this is a winner. This is solid.
One of the best hats ever produced in Major League Baseball.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, if there is a story from the Major League Baseball season, it has to be the 2023 Orioles. Over the prior 162 games, the Orioles have racked up the second best record in the entire American League. They are currently 26-13, the 40th game of the year. The quarter pole is today. They are currently on a pace to win 106 games. They probably won't do that, but if they go 500 the rest of the way, they'll win 95 games this season. Len, I know you are one of that vaunted few, and in fact, you are probably the only person who, besides earning their three-appearance smoking jacket for Forward Maryland appearances, which also gets you into the Forward Maryland three-appearance lounge, which incidentally happens to be at Sapwood Cellars.
No in way. Columbia.
It is. It absolutely is. You know, you're also the only person who's done that. And then also, if memory serves, thrown out a pitch at both the first pitch at both Nationals Park and Oriole Park. So I know both teams are near and dear to your heart, Len. What are you making of the Orioles out of the gate?
It's just absolutely, it's a beautiful, wonderful, thrilling story. I'm a diehard Nationals fan. That's well established. We are actually outperforming expectations, but we're not going to win anywhere this year.
This is true. The Nationals are also starting to trend up.
They're starting, yeah. And this is a rebuilding. We're at the beginning of a rebuild after a long and distinguished run that yielded 5 division titles, a National League pennant in the 2019 World Series. The Orioles are at the start of something truly good. And I live in Baltimore. I can walk to the stadium, and I have a couple of times now. I'll be there tomorrow night when Shohei Ohtani takes the mound at Camden Yards, and that's going to be something truly a sight to behold. But just the energy and the enthusiasm, the crowds have been disappointing throughout the early part of this year. I was disappointed because I was there for one of the Tampa Bay games, mm-hmm. and I think the announced crowd was 13,000. I think that's going to uptick as the weather gets warmer, and as spring gives way to summer. But there is just the fans who are in. There's just such a sense of excitement, and energy, and enthusiasm. These kids who play for the Orioles, the Rutschmans, the Mountcastles, the Mateos. They clearly love playing the game. They haven't. Mm-hmm. They're not old enough to have been jaded by the business of baseball. Everything about this is just fresh and new. Mm-hmm. It is great for a franchise that's been on its back for so long, and it's something that Baltimore needs right now. I can't think of a city that needs this more than Baltimore needs this.
I cannot agree with you more. I mean, I I bought into the O's for a 13 game plan for the first time this year. And I said, you know, this is ground floor. And I mean, already for next year, I'm not even thinking of 29. I'm thinking of the full 81, because why not? As the saying goes, you know, this is an amazing team to watch. They actually get better as the game goes on. Pardon my scratch there. You know, they have a underrated bullpen, which makes up for a slight bit of deficiency in the starting rotation. But the most exciting thing I see about this team is that they're only going to get better over the next 2 to 3 years, as the couple of the pitching prospects they have mature. You know, there's already talk about, you know, will the Orioles be sellers or buyers at the trade deadline? Will they sell away some of their pipeline of talent in order to add a quality starting pitcher or two? I actually think they will trade away some players who are currently with the team. And I think, you know, you mentioned Urias and Mateo. I think one of them may be gone. I think Adam Frazier may be gone. I think at least one of their starting outfielders, or two of their top five outfielders, between Santander, Stowers, Hayes, Mullins, you know, and I'm forgetting one. Kyle, did I mention Stowers? I can't remember.
Maybe Ryan McKenna.
Ryan McKenna. Right. I think they'll be gone because you can get more for players with major league experience, and the players coming up behind them are ready.
And remember, the Orioles do have the best farm system in baseball, objectively determined. So they have, whether you have sellers who are going to be looking for major league ready talent or prospects, mm-hmm. they're going to be in a really good position to go and pick up some talent at the deadline. You know, maybe I'm just throwing out names here, you know, a Salvador Perez from the Royals, another right-handed bat off the bench. You know, another left-handed reliever to take some of the pressure off of Danny Colombe. They're going to be able to pick up some guys in the stretch run, the way the Nationals did throughout its time, when they would routinely at the July 31st trade deadline go and pick up a Kurt Suzuki or a Ryan Madsen or a mm-hmm. Daniel Hudson or a Sean Doolittle, all of whom were deadline acquisitions. I think the Orioles are definitely going to be
And they have Dylan Tate and Michael Givens, who are lefties and righties coming out of the bullpen, currently doing rehab assignments. And then John Means coming back. He is the no-hitter at midseason. Steve, how about them O's?
Well, the thing that when I think about the O's right now, I just – the one word comes to mind, fun. Mm-hmm. It's a fun team to watch. It's a fun game to watch on TV. And I love how the organization and the city have embraced some of their quirkiness. I mean, first it was just a little, you know, water spritz to second base. Then it was the homer hose, and that took off. Now you've got the bird bath. And I don't know if you guys saw the game Friday night, but, you know, of course, Cedric Mullins hits for the cycle. That just took it to a whole nother level. But the whole bird bath thing is already a hit. So it's just fun. But Len, I'm going to expand a little bit and ask you, because you do live in downtown Baltimore, and Bill and I were talking about this. How much fun is it right now for Baltimore with the Orioles now, not just relevant, but like I said, they are almost much CTV. If you saw that Braves series, the Ravens, and, you know, they got Lamar, and then obviously OBJ, they signed Rocky Asin, the draft choices. I mean, how much fun is it for Baltimore sports in general right now with the birds now? Well, both birds, really. The Orioles now relevant, and the Ravens look like they're poised to do something special this year, new offensive coordinator, et cetera.
Well, you hear it around town, right? And when you have a good sports team, when you have a team that's doing well, in a good sports town, which is what Baltimore is, then you just kind of pick up a buzz when you're going out and about, you know. And I hang out at our house a lot, you know, there on 29th Street in Remington. It's where I go and get my coffee. It's where I go and have lunch once in a while. I'll throw down a laptop and you just hear conversations. And what are people talking about? They're talking about the Orioles. And did you see Mullins hit for the cycle? Did you see that bomb that Mountcastle hit last night? Felix Bautista, the Mountain. You know, they're talking about baseball. When you stop at another place in town or a gas station or something, and you hear people talking, they're talking about the Orioles to an extent that I've never heard, because the last time they were this hot was in the 1980s, when probably during the why not season. I think this team is even hotter right now than the 95, the 96, 97 Orioles. The 97 team that went wire to wire.
Yeah.
The teams that had success in 2012, 2014, 2016. Mm-hmm. There's something about this group of guys that has really captured the imagination of the city in a way that we haven't seen since the original Orioles Magic teams of Bumbry, Dower, Singleton, Flanagan, Palmer, et cetera.
So you mentioned that, and I'm just going to cut to the quick, because there's three words that I think both of you guys will remember, but we're not talking about them. The Oriole way. I think that is what we're seeing again after almost 50 years of dormancy, certainly 40 years, is a consistent management and philosophical and strategic structure that the Orioles have implemented from the rookie league all the way up through the major league level. The implementation of that, the drafting of so many players, and they did go outside of the, buy the bats, raise the pitching model. They did the exact opposite. They raised the bats, and they will probably buy some pitching, although they have some prospects coming up through the ranks as well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the affinity that all of these players have for each other, that's an intangible that wins championships. For want of a better word, we see that on the Houston Astros. And I will tell you, this team, the Orioles, took on an energy. I remember being so angry at the 2021 into the 2022 Orioles. They seemed lackluster. Brandon Hyde didn't seem interested in managing games to win. But then a thing happened in early 2022, which was when Adley Rutschman got called up. And it was like the team found its heart. And everybody, you know, the entire organization talks about what an incredible young man he is, what a clubhouse influence he is at what I think he's 25 years old. And, you know, who doesn't want Adley Rutschman to go give you a hug? You know, whenever the Orioles win a game and he takes off his catcher's mask and he's smiling ear to ear and he gives the last pitcher, just a big bear hug. Yeah. That's just an affinity that for all the great collections of talent, and that 96-97 Oriole team was a great collection of talent. But, you know, not sure that their heart was the greatest.
Well, if you remember the 96-97 teams, and they were great. I mean, like I said, 97.
Terrific talent.
They went wire to wire, but it was big name talent. They had imported Rafael Palmeiro. They had
Robbie Alomar, Jimmy Keith, David Wells, Chris Sabo, Andy Van Slyke.
A lot of names. Yeah,
it was big name talent, and so these are guys who had cut their teeth with other organizations, and you know Bobby Bonilla was on the 96 team, right?
That's right.
So you know, it's different because this core nucleus is more like what we saw in the 1970s Orioles, where you did see guys like Bumbrey and Dower and Dempsey and Flanagan and McGregor come up and start their illustrious careers with the Orioles. And I think there's something really gratifying. And I've been through this with the Nationals, and what's happening in Baltimore in 2023 is just what happened with the Nationals in 2012. And I'll tell you, as someone who watched the Nationals go from a perennial 100 loss team to winning that first division title in 2012, you will never, ever forget this season. I tell all my diehard Oriole friends, I just may have coined a new word there, friends. It's like friends and fans. My Oriole friends, take as many pictures both on your cell phones and mentally as possible, because you will never, ever want to forget this year. It will never be as sweet and as perfect as what's happening this year if they last the entire year. Whether they beat the Rays for the division title or make it as a wild card, they'll never be this good again.
No, I think we're entering the first of about a good 5 year or so run at least.
And my big memory in recent, you know, growing up in Orioles fan, my big recent memory, and every once in a while you'll see the clip of the Orioles Tigers game when Delmon Young hits the double down the line and scores three. And you see the sea of orange, and you watch the cameras. The stadium is literally shaking. And I'm looking for that moment. And to your point, Len, I think if they keep up the way they are, the crowds will pick up as the weather warms up. I think we will in September. I can't even imagine Baltimore in September, the Ravens starting out their season, the Orioles in the heart of the pennant race with jam-packed crowds. I forget what year it was, but – it was a doubleheader. I was at Fells Point for the festival, and the Orioles and the Ravens were playing the same day. The Orioles were the playoffs. The Ravens, I think, might have just had a home game. One of the greatest atmospheres in that city. I'm looking forward to that. But I'm glad you mentioned Adley Rutschman, because I think if you want to know what is the telltale of where this team is going, the moment he gets signed to a long extension takes everything to another level. I do believe they will do that, because there's only one of him. You got like 56 middle infielders, which is why Mateo can be traded. You know, they got a bunch of guys coming up. There's only one Rutschman. And I think inside of a year they will extend him, and this place will go nuts.
He has a chance to be the sixth statue out on the concourse at Camden Yards.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's five right now. What? So it's Eddie.
It's six now.
Six.
It's 4, 5, 8, 20, 22, 33. Yeah. Weaver, Brooks, Cal, Frank Robinson, Palmer, and
Brooks. And Brooks. Brooks.
Yeah. 4, 5, 8.
I had forgotten about Weaver.
It's six.
So Rutschman has the potential, if he is signed to that long-term deal, which I hope to God he is, and if he can spend the vast majority, if not the entirety of his career in this town, he does have the ability to be the potential to be that seventh statue out there on the concourse, and to be one of those civic icons that defines this era of Oriole baseball. You know what he is? He is to the Orioles what Ryan Zimmerman was to the Nationals.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the franchise icon, the face of the franchise, who was there to guide us from the era of mediocrity to through the epic of excellence. And Ryan Zimmerman, his memory will burn eternal in Washington baseball lore.
Yeah, you're right.
Rutschman has that same transcendent possibility.
If he
stays healthy, if he maintains his level of performance, and if he stays in an Oriole uniform. So lots of big ifs.
Yeah.
But he has that potential.
Yeah.
Hey, how about tomorrow night, guys? The Orioles, who are surging, coming into Baltimore, or coming into the game tomorrow night, riding a high with another series win against the Pirates, maybe sweeping. But they're going to face Shohei Ohtani, who is the best baseball player on earth.
Well, it's going to be great. It's going to be fantastic. I mean,
oh, we won. Man.
We won guaranteed 4 out of 6 against the 2 teams in baseball with better records than us between the Rays and the Pirates. So that ain't bad. And it might be five out of six after today. Yeah. Incidentally, to your point about the attendance, Len, I was there Wednesday. It was 18,000. Friday, it was 26. And there was a nice walk up. I don't know what it was yesterday, but yesterday wasn't great weather. But with Mother's Day today, you know, and a beautiful day for a ball game, if there's anything less than 30,000 in the stands, I'll be unhappy.
I'm going to go if the Orioles continue along this course and win 90 to 95 games and go into the playoffs, I'm going to circle those 6 games in the month of May against the Atlanta Braves and the Tampa Bay Rays as the week that they proved that they were real. Because even though, you know, they played the Braves tough that entire weekend series. They lost 2 or 3 to the Braves. The Braves are a dynasty. The Braves are the Braves. They need no introduction. And the Orioles proved that they belong on that same field down in Atlanta and then came back and won 2 out of 3 from the very best team in baseball. Yeah, those 6 games will be remembered, I think, as the inflection point on this season.
Hey, guys. I know we've been talking about Shohei, but I haven't had a chance to look at the order for the Orioles. Do we maybe get Grayson Rodriguez tomorrow night?
I have to go back and check.
If we get G-Rod versus Shohei, oh my goodness.
Yeah, that would be – no, we do not because he did not start on Wednesday. We might get Grayson today, but because he pitched Tuesday – but we would get Wednesday's starter, who was Dean Kramer.
Kramer.
Okay.
I'll have been to 3 games, and all 3 of them were Dean Kramer starts. It's like that 1 year I went to 20 Nats games because I was on a 20-game plan, and 13 of them were Gio Gonzalez starts.
Lord, you got to try for that. That had to have been almost every start he made all season there.
It was great because it was the year that – it was that 2012 season when Gio went 20-12.
Oh, okay. You got good Gio. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Len, we're bringing this podcast to a close. So I believe Steve will join me in these comments, sir. We certainly thank you for your continued patronage and willingness to appear and talk about a wide range of topics from the media landscape of the 2020s to the worth of hiding a roll of quarters carefully tucked within your sock for that moment when it might be needed as a foreign object to dominate your opponents.
Or when Mr.
So
Mr.
I'd like
Mr.
to give
Fuji.
You this board to, you know, any special reminiscences or perhaps regrets that you ever have of being on this fine podcast production.
I have enjoyed every single minute, every single millisecond of being on the show with you guys. The two of you are genuine Renaissance men. The sheer breadth of topics that we can discuss, like you said, from the future of the Democratic Party to Mr. Fuji putting the evil salt packet into his trunk
salt pouch,
and throwing it into the eyes of an unsuspecting Tony Gurria and enabling he and his partner Mr. Saito to capture the WWF tag belts on TV from Allentown, Pennsylvania. Whatever the topic may be, no one has done it in a more knowledgeable way, and has done it with better humor and a sense of friendship than you guys. You're icons. You will never, ever be forgotten in this business.
Oh, thank you, Len. That means a whole lot coming from you. That is awesome. And again, we have a lot of good podcasts. A lot of times, you know, Bill and I have been talking recently about how some of these podcasts were like, wow, that was pretty good. But these are always fun with you because of what we can cover. And you know, we can throw out anything, and you know, I mean, hey, throw in craft beer. I mean, we just talked about mushroom infused beer. Where else are you going to get that? except for a show involving one Lynn Foxwell. So thank you, Lynn, for everything. We really appreciate the support, man.
Thank you.
And I've got books for you, Lynn.
Really?
Yeah, you know I've done.
I know you have.
I made my blog into books.
So let's figure out a time, and the three of us can get together at Sapwood.
Yes.
And maybe enjoy a Graveyard of Forgotten Gods stout or whatever they're rolling out the next can release. And let's raise a glass and talk about the future and what comes next.
I would love that. We're going to make it happen, Captain.
Our best days are still ahead, gentlemen.
Damn straight. And Steve, that's a great note to end on. You got anything else to top that one, or just anything else?
I got nothing, man. That was awesome. And yes, that is on because Bill's not giving me my books either. So we could do a whole book and toast and
Here's on the 30th, the last podcast at the undisclosed
location. That's true. We are going to see each other. Okay.
Don't you guys talk?
No, we've never done a live podcast with just the two of us until the 30th. The last podcast we do is going to be the only one we've ever done in the same location.
It will be the greatest assemblage of intellectual firepower since Thomas Jefferson last dined alone.
Oh Lord, I'm hoping it approximates the artistic qualities of Andy Kaufman's epic My Breakfast with Blassie.
Oh, from 1982.
Yes,
sir. Wow. Or if there had ever been a time, either before or after the tapings, when the Grand Wizard Freddie Blassie and Captain Lou Albano, the three wise men, ever broke bread together and devised their evil plans for domination.
All I got to say, Bill, is if I show up and you've got a coconut, I'm turning around and going home.
Oh, the evil coconut.
Who said the coconut would be for you?
Exactly. That's why I'm leaving.
Coconut might be.
Just when Steve Hunt thinks he has all the answers, Bill Woodcock changes the questions.
Nothing was better than when Gene Okerlund followed Piper and Orton out into the alley after they were kicked out of the clinic where Orton's long-heeled arm was found to be a ruse. And then all of a sudden, Piper and Orton took the boots to a random passerby in the alley while Gene Okerlund said, "Piper, you stop this now!" Well, I never.
Never. He's always stunned.
So much I learned about how to socialize as an elementary and middle school child came out of that.
It's remarkable that a broken arm on a world-class athlete took, by my count, approximately two years to heal. Yeah.
It's absolutely a phenomenon. I mean, he must have been diabetic.
A healing pattern that was second in its lethargy only to Iron Mike Sharp's forearm strain, which required him to have the controversial arm brace on for the entirety of his WWF run.
Right.
Yeah, or very much approximated by Glenn Davis's shoulder.
Also a 5 to 6 year ordeal.
Right.
But hey, by the way, I know we're off topic. You got to go, but Bob Orton, one of the most underrated challengers to Bob Backlund during his entire 6 year reign. Bob Backlund as a technical wrestler could actually go hold for hold and maneuver to maneuver with Bob Backlund. I saw him wrestle in the Civic Center one night back in 82, and Orton put on a show, man.
Orton was the stuff. Orton was pretty good. He could go, and I don't know, but Mrs. Orton must have been quite the person, because you know Randy's a good looking guy. I mean, that's the Liv Tyler, Steven Tyler thing. I mean, how does such an ugly person beget a
good looking guy like Randy Orton?
Handsome offspring and a good looking offspring, and wow, you know, Orton had some skills.
Well, he earned a lot of money from collecting the $25,000 bounty that was on Ric Flair's head down in the old Mid-Atlantic area in 1983. when he and Dick Slater put the boots to Ric Flair and collected the $25K from Harley Race. Probably was able to wine and dine Mrs. Orton.
Doubtless he put that into Apple.
He did what? He put
He put that $25K bounty into Apple. And then look at how much money he's got today.
If only Harley Race had done the same thing. No, he goes and gives it to Dick Slater and Bob Orton, and he's still losing the belt at Starrcade.
Dick Slater put the money into Apples, which, you know, explains a whole lot of problems with Dick Slater.
Oh. Lots of problems with Dick Slater. May God rest his rebel soul.
Yes. Unintended topic.
We have riffed again. How angry are we making people right now? Will anybody watch the last episode? Probably not.
Yeah, because I won't be on there. You guys will get record viewership.
Indubitably, kind sir, from our undisclosed location in Annapolis. But I'm not going to give it up. I want a groupie to come. I want us to have a groupie. Steve doesn't want to have groupies. I want groupies. Anyway.
What's Josh Friedman doing?
Stop. Him and Orson are cool.
Okay. Who's Orson? Is that the dog?
Orson's the little dude who he brings to the Bay Sox games. Yeah, Orson.
Okay. I thought it was Rupert.
Rupert, I believe, is in the kennel in the sky.
Okay. Rupert. We will always remember Rupert fondly.
Will we?
I will, at least.
Good. Leave it at that. Because
did you see Josh tell him I said hi? I wish him well.
I'm having flashbacks to a certain Monday afternoon on Facebook where all three of us did things of which we were not proud.
Actually, more money on spilt liquor.
I was extremely proud of that. I still laugh when thinking about that. Laugh to the point of tears.
I spent more money on spilt liquor and bars from one end of this world to another than you made.
Finally, someone inflame people so much because I've used it several times, and for some reason, it just makes whoever you tell that to outrage. Really angry.
It just triggers people, and I can't remember who it was. It may have been Joan Pontius, or someone had to step in and say, "Mr. Foxwell, don't you have anything better to do?" And I said, "Well, clearly not." Oh, man, we still got the tax
refunds out. Anything better to do.
It was a Monday. It was a Monday in July. Give me a break. I wasn't hurting anybody.
You were just spilling some liquor.
Spilled liquor day.
Every day is a spilled liquor day in Howard County.
Amen to that.
All right. This has been another edition. This has been the anti-penultimate edition of Forward Maryland. Thanking our guest Len Foxwell, for Steve Hunt. My name is Bill Woodcock. Take care, everybody.
Hey, guys. Bye.